Chaloka Dipati Sahampati Katam Jaliyaham Adiyaram Ayachata Santi Disata Paraja Dejadika Dese Tudamam Anukam Pimam Pajam.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, so a lot of things coming together this evening, Saturday night, which is a regular day for Dhamma talks. It's also a full moon, lunar observance day. So people have come and requested the refuges and precepts. And, of course, it's also the Spirit Rock Teen Weekend. So there's a lot of the teens here over these 2 days. Before I start the Dhamma talk, I thought I'd just explain a bit about the one taking of the refuges and precepts is something that, say, the teens did last night as a part of coming to stay in the monastery. But it's also something that in the Buddhist tradition from the time of the Buddha, people would take on the lunar observance nights, they would take the refuges precepts. And it's for a day and a night. So it's take it for a day and a night for that day of the lunar observance, a day and that night. And there's a discourse where the Buddha is recounted as reflecting to himself. Because it was the tradition in the Buddha's time in India to go to the different places where the different religious wanderers, religious teachers on the lunar quarters and listen to teachings, practice with them. And the Buddha was reflecting about the, giving a bit of structure to it, giving a better focus, and thinking about, these 8 precepts are a good way to provide that focus. In general, the Buddha encourage the 5 precepts on a daily life basis, which give a basis of integrity and a virtue that is a structure for living a skillful life in the world. 8 precepts are something like a simplification or have a certain element of relinquishment to them, simplifying, relinquishing things that aren't so essential for living a focused spiritual life. So the Buddha, in his reflection, he was sort of, the arahants, those fully enlightened beings, live their whole life and not taking the life of any living creature. What if the lay community live for a day and a night, not taking the life of any living creature, living just like the arahants? And, the arahants live their whole life not taking what isn't given. What if the lay community had a day and a night living like the arahants? And so that's basically what those 8 precepts are. It's kind of that's how enlightened being, somebody who has peace and benevolence in their hearts, that's how they live. And it's sort of an opportunity to give the lay community to participate in that holy life. So that that was the Buddha's logic and his intention of giving that opportunity to the lay community to share in the living of a holy life. So after taking the precepts, then Anagarika Armand did a chant in the scriptural language, and what that is a formal request for teachings. Generally, say as a Buddhist monk, you're not supposed to just teach everybody, tell them the truth, expound the Dharma to everybody who comes along, get up on your soapbox and really give it to them. You have to be invited to teach. So that is a formal request to share the teachings. And it's actually a scriptural, it's a phrases from the scriptures from the time when the Buddha was first enlightened, first awakened, and he's made this breakthrough, he's penetrated the Dhamma, he's fully enlightened, and his first thought is, nobody's going to understand this. I don't know. I don't know if I should bother teaching. I don't know if anybody's going to understand this. I just tire myself needlessly. And as the story goes, one of the Brahma gods understood that thought of the Buddha's and said, "Oh, this is a disaster. The world is really going to be not benefit from this." So so this Brahma god comes down and makes a request, as that those Pali phrases, please, there are beings with little dust in their eyes, please teach the Dhamma for their benefit and growth. So that's when the Buddha decides to teach. Then, say for myself, before teaching, I recite the Namo Tassa Bhagavato three times. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. I pay respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. And that's for me to set the intention to that what I'm trying to teach or what I'm trying to act out of is out of respect to the Buddha, and out of respect to the Triple Gem, and to share what I can, but it's done out of a sense of an intention to try to maintain that connection of respect and devotion to the Buddha, and that's a helpful reminder in a sense. It's not one. It's not a personal thing. It's not me trying to say something that's clever and smart and you'll clap and applaud. It's trying to share something that is worthwhile and in harmony with the intention of the Buddha Dhamma and Sangha. So that's the spirit that we try to teach with. Also, when we teach, Ajahn Chah, my teacher in Thailand, would always encourage us to not plan or research or figure out what we're going to teach to anybody, but make the heart peaceful and speak from the heart and see what comes out. The most senior Western disciple of Ajahn Chah is Ajahn Sumedho, and he's been a monk now for almost 50 years. But when he was a young monk, training under Ajahn Chah in Thailand, after he'd been a monk for a few years, Ajahn Chah invited him to give a Dhamma talk, to the share some reflections to the lay community. And he knew it was going to happen, so he actually had it all planned out in his mind. Because it's kind of intimidating to get up in front of a bunch of people and talk. So he had it all planned out. He got up and he gave this brilliant discourse in his Thai language that he practiced, the words that he could say what he wanted to say. And he finished the talk, came down back into the assembly, paid respects to Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Chah just sort of said quietly to him, "Don't do that again. Just speak from the heart." It was a really important teaching for Ajahn Sumedho, in that sense of obviously we rely on our memory, we rely on our experience, we rely on the teachings that we've learned, but the Dhamma should really be something that is responding to a need or a circumstance that we're in. Say today at tea time, it was interesting that a lot of the questions that were being asked, and mostly by the teens, were around just that element of dukkha, of that central piece of the Buddha's teachings around. Dukkha is translated usually as suffering, but it has many, many different connotations. Suffering, dis-ease, discontent, dissatisfaction, stress. So that's a fundamental teaching. And it was actually the first teaching that the Buddha gave. After his enlightenment, and he heeded the advice of the Brahma God, then he went and sought out the friends who were practicing with him, his first students or disciples, and they had been practicing with him, and they'd gone off elsewhere. And so the Buddha, I thought, they'll understand. So he went and tracked them down. And his first teaching was structured around the Four Noble Truths, this truth of dukkha, the truth that there is suffering, there is dukkha. But there's also a cause. I mean, it's not as if it's just unrelenting, unending suffering. There is a cause, and there is an end. There's a cessation to suffering. And there is a path, a practice, leading to the end of suffering, of dukkha. So that this teaching of his that he gave his, say that this first occasion, throughout his whole, he lived a long life. He began teaching at the age of 35. He died at the age of 80. So that in 45 years of teaching, that structure of those Four Noble Truths always was a theme that carried through over and over. It wound its way through the teachings over that whole 45-year period. I think that insight that he had, that was his awakening, gave that clarity of understanding that this is a way to really help people. Because everybody, I mean, it's just like this afternoon at tea time. I mean, everybody's interested in suffering. It doesn't matter you're young or old, you're male, you're female, you live in America, you come from somewhere else in the world. Everybody's interested in suffering. I mean, in the sense that it's important. It's not unimportant. And it's kind of fundamental to our life. As long as we're feeling this sense of stress, of discontent, dissatisfaction, and everything has it feels a kind of off. It doesn't feel quite right. It doesn't feel it's like the word dukkha. It's actually really interesting because in the scriptural language, it's quite an old word that was around for a long, long time in the Indian language. And what it refers to is the northern India, the culture is it's a horse culture. So they have horses, they have chariots, carts, wheels that they go everywhere with. And so that in the language, tu means something that is not good, and sukh means something that's good. Like dukkha is suffering, sukha is happiness. And then, so tu is sort of, okay, it's not good, not quite right. Ka is it's like where the axle of a cart goes into the wheel. So when it's not good, it's not right, it doesn't go smoothly, there's a problem, it doesn't feel right, it's dukkha. it's unsatisfactory, it's complicated, it's uncomfortable. So that's the connotation of what, say, what dukkha is. It isn't sort of some, miserable problem of yourself. It's sort of, it doesn't work. It doesn't quite fit. And I'm sure that's our experience in life. Something is not quite right. And so that recognizing that is... Well, that it's not right because it's not right. It's not smooth. So that being able to get your finger on that and say, rather than trying to sort of say, "Oh, everything's okay, everything's fine. Oh, so nice, isn't it wonderful?" It's like say from my generation, sort of the Pollyanna effect of the. Everything's nice, everything's wonderful, it's all good. But as long as you don't sort of see it for what it is, then you can't really deal with it. It's like you just sort of keep going along in this cart, this plump, 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 plump. Well, it's all fine. So you never fix it. You don't deal with it. When the Buddha gave these Four Noble Truths as a teaching, part and parcel of the Four Noble Truths is also the kind of like the duty or responsibility that one has to that noble truth. So there is the noble truth of dukkha, and what we need, what is needed to be done with it, is that it needs to be understood. So that it needs to be known, it needs to be understood. So that's what we have to be willing to know it and understand it. So it's just bringing that experience or that reality to light, and then being willing to be attentive, watch it, investigate it, understand it. I mean, sometimes people will criticize Buddhism as it being it's like really pessimistic because all it talks about is dukkha. It's so negative to think about dukkha. But, it's kind of like what the Buddha, one of the things that the Buddha called himself is like he's a doctor or a physician for the world. So he's looking after one's well-being. And If you go to a doctor and a doctor asks, where does it hurt? I mean, you don't sort of say, what a negative doctor, I'm not going to... what a hopeless case that is. You realize, oh, well, that's what's needed to be known for a treatment. A doctor needs to know what's actually wrong so that there can be a course of treatment. So similarly, with our own existence, dukkha is to be known. So that's being willing to know it. And also recognizing when we say dukkha or suffering, you know, there's different kinds of dukkha. And it comes under three big headings in the scriptures. So the first one is dukkha. So it's suffering that's suffering. So there's ordinary things. Illness. Say you're sick, you're ill. Okay, it's dukkha. It is, say, unpleasant, uncomfortable to be ill. But then there's sort of we can make dukkha out of that dukkha. Why am I ill? Why me? and that, of course, that complicates it. Or it shouldn't be this way. And that complicates it. It makes that one adds dukkha to the dukkha. And there's certain elements, you know, both physically as well as, say, emotionally. And it isn't as if the Buddha himself didn't feel anything. Because, say, the Buddha himself had there's reference in the suttas to the discourses to the Buddha experiencing back pain and not being able to continue teaching, and he has to delegate the teaching to somebody else. And there's several places where the Buddha says, you know, he's been giving a teaching, and he said, you know, the assembly is alert, is awake, they're interested in the teachings. And he said, my back's hurting, sorry Buddha, please continue teaching. And he goes off and lies down to have a rest, because that's what you do when you've got a bad back. And it's sort of, you look after yourself, and it isn't sort of, oh, here I am enlightened and I can't even put up with a little back pain, you know. it doesn't turn into a big sort of problem or a self-perception. It's what it is. Dukkha is like this. And it needs to be understood. And then one adjusts oneself accordingly. Similarly, another heading of dukkha is what's called the dukkha of separation. So that separation from the love, separation from what one likes, separation from what one prefers, separation from what one's comfortable with. It's always going to feel uncomfortable. And again, you know, one can really make a problem out of it or personalize it or take it as a personal affront that it's like that. But yeah, separation is ordinary, whether it's just through the natural events. It's like, that was really sweet, actually, with there was a, I guess it'd be about a month ago, and there was a brother and sister came to stay here, and they came last year, and came this year to stay. And the boy is, this year was, I think, 8, and the girl was, he was 9, and the little sister was 5. And stayed overnight, and actually a couple nights. And then at 5 years old, the concept of you can come back is not there. It's sort of like separation is like goodbye forever. And she didn't want to go. It was just that separation. She loved it here. And of course, the boy's a little bit older, so that next year I'll be able to come back. It's all very rational. But the feeling of, say, at 5 years old, is that it's not going to end. So that it was both very, it was kind of heartbreaking to see this little girl, so not wanting to leave, crying, and but then, that she enjoyed it, she loved it. So that separation from the loved is something that it's just part of our human existence. And it's something that is saying similar. It isn't as if the Buddha didn't feel anything. It's like there's a really touching discourse where the Buddha it's like getting toward the end of his life, and he's getting to be close to 80 years old. And within the fairly recent, it's not exact, but fairly recently, prior to that, his two chief disciples have passed away. Sariputta and Moggallana. I think Moggallana passed away first. And then sometime later, some months later, then Sariputta passed away. And these were the two chief disciples. And the Buddha is sitting with the community, and he just sort of says, "The assembly seems empty to me without Sariputta and Moggallana." It's really beautiful because that's the feeling. He spent a whole life, and how eventful is it, having this one of this enlightened being, and then drawing these other incredibly good beings together, and it turns into a kind of a movement that has lasted for 2,500 years. But at the time, there's this incredible bond and connection, and the Buddha acknowledging that. And so, this is what it feels like. But then he says, "But haven't I always told you that whatever we come into contact with is always going to be impermanent?" And it's not just sort of dismissive, but it's sort of acknowledging the feeling, but then holding it with that sense of, this is known, this is understood, and we can hold it. So that's that quality of knowing dukkha, understanding dukkha, the dukkha of separation. And then the last one is the dukkha of things being of a compounded nature, so that whatever is of a compounded nature is always going to be a bit unsatisfactory. Because it's dependent on all sorts of different factors in order for it to exist. The technical term from the scripture, sankhara dukkha. It's because things are built up of a compounded nature. It's like just having a human body. On a certain level, it's always going to be uncomfortable. We've been sitting here for a while. We spent a whole day. There's tiredness. There's a bit of discomfort. There's pain, and it's not overwhelming particularly, but it's present. So that when things are of a compounded nature, there's always some things are coming into being. Some things are falling apart, and that's the way it is. So trying to make everything sort of be sort of onward and upward all the time, it's just really hard to do, as it's the nature of compounded things. There's many different causes and effects coming together, and sometimes they're working across purposes. And one of the things that comes to mind is our neighbor when she was passing away. Cancers going through, the body sort of shutting down. She had a bit of a fall, and the body's healing. You know, there's sort of the cuts healing, the bruises healing. So it's like, okay, part of it's healing, part of it's falling apart, and that's kind of how it works. So that this thing, the dukkha of things being of a compounded nature, or just trying to say we're like sitting in a hall like this. Okay, outside the air is getting cooler. Inside, we're sitting here. We got the windows open. But trying to get a perfect temperature is impossible. We got a whole bunch of heat-generating bodies in here. It's of a compounded nature. It's trying to get it perfect is really hard. And it's not something to be complained about or worried about or obsess over, but it's sort of, oh, this is the way it is. And then it can be held. And that's that. Dukkha is to be known. Dukkha is to be understood. And then we can hold it. When we're holding it skillfully, then we can reflect on what are the causes of the dukkha that makes the heart waver, shake, create that feeling of discontent or disconcerted, where we're not at ease. And the Buddha points, this is where it comes to, this is something that we can be working with, because those inner causes are qualities of the heart. The different types of desire, grasping, trying to get things a certain way. And there's ways that we do that that are always going to be frustrating in the sense of, say, that desire for things to always be pleasurable. You know, sometimes you can make it pleasurable, but sometimes you can't. So then that obsession with trying to make things gratifying, pleasurable, make it all happy and good. Yeah, well, forget that one. Which doesn't mean you acquiesce to miserableness, but it's sort of like, get it in context. Realize, because we create problems by trying to get something out of our experience that isn't there. Because it is interesting that when the Buddha talks about the goal, say Nibbana, as the goal of the Buddha's practice, he speaks of that as the highest happiness, the highest bliss, because there's a freedom there. There's this possibility of a transcendent or a unshakable bliss of happiness. It's possible. But as long as we're trying to get it, trying to grasp it, trying to make it be the way we want it, it's going to be frustrating. Also, the desire that's sort of bound up with a sense of self, the sense of me, of mine, trying to become, trying to get, in order that it satisfies or gratifies the sense of, say, of me, this identity. And that'll be frustrating. Because me is actually not the sense of self is actually not an entity. It's a whole committee. And who knows who's in charge of the committee at different times. Anybody who's had to be in on committee meetings. And similarly, on the opposite way of, say, the desire to not become, shouldn't be this way, I don't want to be like this, I don't want the world to be like this. that person shouldn't be like that. That kind of that non-becoming, non-being, don't want it, push it away. That's going to increase dukkha. So that seeing those kinds of desires, understanding them, and again the speaking of the say the duty or responsibility that we have to the cause of dukkha. Say the cause of dukkha is to be relinquished. It's to be let go of. And usually what we do is we try to let go of suffering and we hang on to the causes. And then, well, that's a problem. So that recognize it, being willing to be patient with that experience of dukkha so that we can understand it, we can know it, we can see it. And then it starts to clarify, oh, what's really the root cause? What's really the origin here? And what can I do with that? Well, I can, because what, that understanding will come of that as well. That can be relinquished. That can be let go of. That's where the direct result of that is. That's going to be a cessation of dukkha. That's going to be an experience of that ending of dukkha. And of course, when there's an ending of dukkha, that opens up the space for well-being, happiness, peace, clarity. That's where it becomes very, very pleasurable, very comfortable. And that's where, and the Buddha, the duty, the responsibility that we have to that cessation of dukkha as a noble truth, that is to be realized. It's to be kind of made manifest. It's to be realized. And then the path leading to the cessation of dukkha is the Buddha gives you the toolkit for how to bring this into being. And that's what the duty, the responsibility is to bring it into being, to actually do it. And that's where the Buddha teaches the Eightfold Path. This Eightfold Path of beginning with the elements of discernment, of wisdom, right view, right intention, and then leading into the elements of right action, our development of the aspects of virtue and integrity, right speech, right action, right livelihood. And then the elements of, development of the heart, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, right meditation. So that's a path that we can do. We can incorporate that. And it isn't just a linear path, number one to number eight. You're developing it all at the same time. It's all of a piece. And as you take an interest in one aspect, it'll start to shine light on other aspects. And you start realizing, oh, this all works together. This all fits. This is an integral whole. Because, of course, our aspects of our being, body, speech, and mind, they're part of the same whole, the same. So that learning how to cultivate, learning how to develop. And it's that cultivation of the path that allows us to realize the fruits of this practice, the fruits of the teachings. In the chanting that we do, those qualities of the Dhamma, those are to be realized for each wise person for themselves. That's something we can do. We can realize it, we can feel it, we can experience it. It's not just some kind of nebulous goal sometime somewhere else. It's sort of like the years ago there was a bumper sticker that was kind of me happy somewhere else, some other time. That's the story of most of our lives. But the Buddha's teaching is very different. Oh, no. Yeah. Right here, right now, this is realizable. We can do it. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.
Sa